Let's join together in prayer. So, Lord Jesus, we confess that you are the way and the truth and the life, even though sometimes it's difficult for us to believe that because so many voices are telling us that they are the way and the truth and the life to God, or the way and the truth and the life to success or happiness. Sometimes, Lord, it's even our own voices. We think we are the way and the truth and the life. And so we make this confession this morning, knowing our hearts are not always perfectly aligned with this confession. Spirit of Jesus, hover over us now, as you have been hovering over us in this service. We've experienced much already. And as you hovered over the creation, as you hovered over the early church, hover over us and fill us and do your work in and through us who are believers, us who are unbelievers, us who are doubters or skeptics. As your word is read, as we reflect on your word, Spirit of Jesus, lift up the name and the person of Jesus among us and draw us to Jesus the Messiah. Make Jesus real to us this morning. Spirit of the living God. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Let's take out our Bibles and turn together. We're going to read two passages this morning from the prophet Isaiah chapter 62 and from the Gospel of John chapter 2. So if you have a Bible, either a book or on your phone or tablet, let's take that out. Isaiah 62 and John chapter 2. We're going to read that in a few moments. This morning we're starting three Sundays, starting today and the next two Sundays, three messages on the theme of meeting Jesus in the Gospel of John. And to be honest, as I organized these, and there should be a new slide up there pretty soon, there we go. As I was thinking about these services and these messages, I sort of thought, well, these are kind of three filler messages as we're waiting for September, as we're waiting for the fall. They seemed a little random to me. I just kind of grabbed three stories from the Gospel of John. But then I realized this is not random how God put this together, I believe, because I'm hoping in the fall a number of us will join small groups for five or six sessions, and we're going to look at quite intently a passage from the end of the Gospel of John. John chapter 20, the last few verses there, where Jesus, as he's risen from the dead, after he's risen from the dead, he says to his disciples, "As the Father has sent me, so I'm sending you." Which really are amazing words. As God the Father sent God the Son, in the same way God the Son is sending the church into the world. So we're going to spend a number of weeks in the fall unpacking those words, unpacking this passage. And then I realized these three Sundays are really preparation for the fall. This Jesus who said these words, we're asking in these three Sundays, who is this Jesus who was sent by the Father into the world and who is sending us in the same way into the world? Who is this Jesus who was sent by the Father? What was his ministry? And if we understand him and his ministry, how does that help us understand our ministry in the world? So a bridge to the fall, but also foundational messages as we get ready for our fall small group experiences. I want to invite James to come up and read some verses from Isaiah 62, and then this great story of Jesus from John chapter 2.
Verse 1 to 5 from the 62nd chapter of Isaiah. For Zion's sake, I will not keep silent. For Jerusalem's sake, I will not remain quiet. Till her righteousness shines out like the dawn, her salvation like a blazing torch. The nations will see your righteousness, and kings will see your glory. You will be called by a new name that the mouth of the Lord will bestow. You will be a crown of splendor in the Lord's hand and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. No longer will they call you deserted or name your land desolate, but you will be called Hephzibah and your land Beulah. For the Lord will take delight in you, and your land will be married. As a young man marries a maiden, so will your sons marry you. As a bridegroom rejoices over his bride, so will your God rejoice over you. From the second chapter of John. On the third day, a wedding took place at Cana in Galilee. Jesus' mother was there, and Jesus and his disciples had also been invited to the wedding. When the wine was gone, Jesus' mother said to him, "They have no more wine." "Dear woman," he said, "why do you involve me? My time has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Do whatever he tells you to do." Nearby stood sticks, stone, water jars, the kind used by the Jews for ceremonial washing, each holding from 20 to 30 gallons. Jesus said to the servants, "Fill the jars with water." So they filled them, and he told them, "Now draw some out and take it to the master of the feast." They did so, and the master of the feast tasted the water that had been turned into wine. He did not know where it had come from, though the servants who had drawn the water did know. Then he called the bridegroom aside and said, "Everyone brings out the choice wine first, and then the cheaper wine after the guests have drunk too much. But you have saved the best till now." This, the first of his miraculous signs, Jesus performed at Cana of Galilee, and thus revealed his glory to his disciples, and his disciples put their faith in him. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. So we haven't done this for a while, but I'm going to invite you, in response to the reading, just to gather in groups of four, five, or six people if you can. And I'm going to ask you just to look around, see if you can invite someone in. And I want you to see if each person, if possible, you don't have to, but if each person could try and indicate what is the main thing going on in this John 2 passage. So what's the main theme of this story, according to you? As you've heard the story just told and read, what's the main theme? So just for about 2 minutes, if you can, four, five, six people, look around a little bit, see if you can gather some people together. And I'm not going to give you much time, but you know, try and gather some kids in, try and gather some youth in if you can, and see if each person can share a little bit. What's the main theme of the story? Thanks for huddling together. I recognize it's not everyone's favorite thing to do in a service, but I think sometimes it's good just for us to have a little interaction ourselves instead of me doing all the talking. You know, you've done a little bit of talking. And I want to focus on this story for a few moments this morning. What's this story all about? That's the main question I want to look at. But there's other questions for me that pop up as I think about this story from John chapter 2. Like, I sometimes wonder, did Jesus know this wedding couple? You know, this bride and this groom, this couple at the feast? And I think almost certainly yes. He must have known them in some way. Maybe they were members of his large extended family, or maybe good friends of the family, but I'm sure that he knew them and that they knew him. I also wonder, had he ever been to Cana before? Had he ever visited the small town of Cana before, which is only 6 kilometers northeast of Nazareth, the hometown of Jesus? And it's a bit of a walk, I think, for most of us to walk 6 kilometers. Maybe some of us do that on a regular basis, but Jesus was a walking person, right? So I'm estimating that at least 30 times or more in his life, he walked 150 kilometers to Jerusalem and 150 kilometers back. So if he's walking, I'm assuming at least once a year to Jerusalem for a feast, 300 kilometers round trip, walking 6 kilometers to Cana is no big deal. Maybe to visit someone, maybe on his way somewhere else, maybe doing some stone masonry work in that small village, but he had been through, he had been to Cana. I also wonder, why is Jesus so rude to his mother? In verse 4, "Woman, why do you involve me?" And I'm going to tell you that everybody, even if you have an NIV, a 2011 NIV, the footnote will say, this is not disrespect. And the scholars I read said, it's not disrespect. It's just an informal way of talking to his mother. It still sounds disrespectful to us. And some of us at Nelson Avenue are having that experience even as we're living in Burnaby or in Canada. I'm sort of hearing some stories of people who are coming from other places, and as they talk here, as they talk in their native land or their native country, they're finding out, oh, I'm just talking normally. I'm not talking rudely, but you think I'm talking rudely to you, but I'm not. I think it's the same kind of experience for us. I always want to trust the scholars who say in that first century, Jesus was not being rude to his mother. I would love to know, and I think I know, basically, how much wine did Jesus actually make? We're told in verse 6 there were 6 stone water jars, each holding 20 to 30 gallons. Just did a quick calculation. That's 120 gallons at the minimum. 450 liters. More than 500 bottles of wine Jesus made. And I would love to know, even though I don't drink a lot of wine, what did that wine taste like? Because we're told it's the best wine. And for me, the best wine is some kind of ice wine. I don't think he made that. But in order to understand this story, you have to have in your mind, at least for us, I think, because we don't have stone water jars, right? So at least 500 bottles of wine, and in each bottle is the best wine. That's Jesus' gift to this couple and to this wedding feast. Now, lots of questions we could ask, but I want to try and focus on the question that you were asking. What's the main theme of this story? And I'm going to give my perspective on the main theme. And some of you might say, he was setting us up, as he does more often. I'm not trying to set you up. I would love to know what you thought was the main theme, and I'm going to give my viewpoint on what I think is the main theme. So is this story mostly about weddings? Is John, the author, telling us this story to show that Jesus approves of weddings? Is that the main deal in the story? I don't think so. Is the wine the main deal? Some people might say, this story tells us it's okay to drink wine, and that's the main message. I don't think so. I don't think the wine is the main deal. Is the main deal that Jesus is an amazing miracle worker? I don't think so. Even though at least one scholar will say this is, besides the resurrection, this is the most amazing miracle that Jesus ever did. I don't think John tells a story to us and to his readers so that we'll say he's an amazing miracle worker. I don't even think John tells us a story to tell us Jesus can turn water into wine. That's, I don't think, the main thing. Now, this story, of course, is told in the Gospel of John, obviously. And the Gospel of John, like I think every other book in the Bible, is amazingly structured. So I found this out again last week, this past Wednesday night, when we had the Tola Lege group over to our house. We're talking about the book of Esther. And I'd never been told and ever seen until I read a little bit how the book of Esther is wonderfully put together. So the main message is right in the middle of the book. Now, John is not structured like that, but John is also structured amazingly. And the first half of the Gospel of John is often called the Book of the Signs. There are seven signs in the first 12 chapters of the Gospel of John. And we should be saying, at least some of us, well, of course there would be seven, right? A number seven keeps showing up in the Bible, this number of perfection, or this number of the creation, these 7 days of creation. And the seven signs are, we have the symbols there, you can follow along, but first of all, turning water into wine. Later on in chapter 4, healing the son of a royal official. Chapter 5, healing a paralyzed man so he can walk again. Chapter 6, feeding more than 5,000 people with a little bit of bread and fish. Later on in chapter 6, Jesus walking on water. Chapter 9, Jesus healing a man born blind. And then chapter 11, which I think is the greatest miracle in this gospel, the raising of Lazarus, the friend of Jesus, from the dead. And our passage right at the end tells us that this is one of the signs. What Jesus did in Cana of Galilee was the first of the signs through which he revealed his glory. Our English word sign, that's the word that's used here, actually helps us, I think, to understand what are these signs. Because in the English language, a sign is always a pointer to something else, right? It's signaling something else. Typically, something bigger or better. The sign is never there saying, look at me, look at me, this is the reality. The sign is always to say there's something bigger than the sign. So a stop sign, of course, is not meant for us to gaze at the stop sign. What a wonderful sign. Whether in English or in French, how red it is. Look at how it's nicely spelled. How it's nicely there put in the ground. That's not the message of the sign. The sign says, stop! Right? You need to stop. That's the bigger reality. Or like a sign that says 33 more kilometers to Vancouver after 14 hours in the van. I'm not focused on the sign. I'm focused on the reality. We're almost there, kids. We're almost there. And here, too, the water into wine is a sign. It's not the main thing. There's something bigger, something better, something more important. We might say, sometimes in our church language, it's a sign of the kingdom. Or the reign, or the rule, or the work, or the power of God, which is true. But our verse says very specifically, it's the first of the signs by which Jesus revealed his glory. So it's going to be a first of a sequence. He's going to reveal his glory, his splendor, his excellence, his brilliance, his beauty, his wonder. The sign is not pointing to a thing. The sign is pointing to a person. And the clue of this is in the previous verses, John 2, verses 9 and 10, where the MC, or the host of the party, after he tastes the wine that Jesus made, he calls the bridegroom aside and says, everyone typically brings out the best wine first, and then the cheaper wine, after the guests have had too much to drink, because at that point they don't really care what the wine tastes like. Right? They're not as able to discern, is this good wine or bad wine or mediocre wine? So typically everyone brings out the best wine, because that's what everyone's you know, fully awake, fully aware, and then later on we'll just give them the leftover wine. But the MC says to the bridegroom, you have saved the best till now. You have saved the best till now. And I want to ask, why does the MC call the bridegroom and tell him this? Why not call the bride? Why not call the bridegroom's father? Well, because the MC assumes the bridegroom supplied the wine. And he assumes that because the bridegroom was supposed to supply all the wine for the whole feast that could last up to 7 days. Which I was thinking, people in that time, they really knew how to have a party. Like, I think 2, 3, 4 hours at the most, that's pretty good for me. But Jesus seems to arrive kind of as the party's going, right? That's on the third day. But these people they're going another 4 days. And at some point, this wine runs out, and Jesus supplies it, and the MC is like, whoa, what have you done, bridegroom? Because it's your job to make sure the wine keeps flowing, and you've done that. And so Jesus, as he supplies more than 500 bottles of the best wine, is saying, I'm a good guy. I'm a nice guy. I'm a miracle worker. He's saying, I'm the bridegroom. Because I supplied the wine that bridegroom was supposed to, but he didn't. So I supplied it for him. And wine, I don't know how you all feel about wine. I don't have to know right now, but wine in the Bible is a huge theme. In the Old Testament, it's a symbol, a pointer to the future reality, the future feast, the future kingdom that God is bringing. So Jesus supplying all this wine is saying, I'm the bridegroom who's bringing in the reality promised by God in the Old Testament. But he's also saying, I'm not just any old bridegroom, right? Because in the passage James read for us from Isaiah 62, God, Yahweh, is called the bridegroom. So Jesus is also saying, I'm the bridegroom who is also God himself. I'm making a claim of divinity by giving and supplying all this best wine. So Jesus is not just saying, I'm helping out, I'm a nice guy, I can do great things. He's putting himself as the bridegroom of this feast and the bridegroom of all that God has promised. And I think we get confirmation of that later on in the next chapter, John chapter 3, where John the Baptist, the cousin of Jesus, talking about Jesus, says in John 3, 29 and 30, the bride belongs to the bridegroom. And the friend, that's John the Baptist, who attends the bridegroom, waits and listens for him, and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That joy is mine, is now complete. He must become greater. I must become less. I was waiting for the bridegroom. He has now shown up. And so I can just retreat into the back, into the corners, and the bridegroom, Jesus, can take center stage. Or Jesus later on saying in John 14, my Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I'm going there to prepare a place for you, which I think gets lost on us, right? We think, oh, he's going to heaven, way far away, and he's going to make a place for us, and then he's going to take us there. And Jesus is using the imagery of the bridegroom again, because this is what bridegrooms did in his culture, right? The bride and the groom were engaged or betrothed, and then the groom said, see you later. I'm going to come back in 3 or 6 or up to 12 months, And I'm going to come and take you to myself, but I first have to make the addition. I first have to build something onto my Father's house, a room or an apartment. I'm going to build a place for you. And when that place is done, I'm going to come back and take you to myself. And Jesus is using the same imagery here, the imagery of the bridegroom. So Jesus says it in John 14, and John the Baptist is a witness to it. And in John 2, Jesus shows us he's the bridegroom by giving us, or giving this party, all this great wine. Now, I have a feeling for some of us, the idea of Jesus as the bridegroom doesn't really land on us, right, really well. Because in our culture, when we think about bridegrooms or grooms, and this is an overgeneralization, not every wedding is like this. I don't think every wedding should be like this, but when we think about grooms, I think many of us think, well, there's the groom. In his tuxedo or his suit, looking sharp and smart, smiling, looking happy. But that's all he really does, right? Not every wedding's like this, but I think the stereotype is he just shows up because somebody else planned it all, right? Somebody else took care of all the preparations. In our culture, for many people, the wedding is all about the bride, her dress, her entrance into the ceremony, her and her friends, or her and maybe her mother, organizing, planning, calling, the colors, everything, and then, oh yeah, please show up on this day at this time, and we'll get married. Now, I know that's not true for every wedding, but I think for many people, that's the association. In the first century culture, that was totally different. The first century Jewish culture, the wedding is all centered around the bridegroom, right? His father had arranged the marriage, had gone to the bride's father, and had done whatever was necessary to arrange this marriage. And then the bridegroom is busy building the room or the apartments. He's arranging the feast. He's bringing his bride or his beloved into his family. He's supplying all the wine. And so Jesus, as he takes on this mantle or shows people who he is saying, this is who I am, not just for this feast, but this is who I am for all of those who believe in me. I am the bridegroom, and I will go further, Jesus says, than other bridegrooms. I'm going to lay down my life for my bride. I'm going to sacrifice my life for my people. And he hints at this in the story when he tells his mother, my hour has not yet come. And whenever we hear about the hour in the Gospel of John, it's always the hour of the suffering and death of Jesus. So Jesus, the bridegroom, providing all we need, doing whatever is needed for our life and for our good, so committed to us that he will sacrifice his life to secure our life and our good. Really, he presents himself as the all in all, our all in all. And the one final thing I want to say about Jesus the bridegroom is that Jesus comes into this wedding, and the one thing he does, among other things, is he lifts the shame off this couple. And not just lifts it up and then points to them as a look what they did or look what they couldn't do, right? He doesn't make a big deal. This is an amazing thing about Jesus in the story. It's almost like he's incognito. He's almost like he's hiding in the background, doesn't want anyone to know. And in this culture, which like other cultures, even in our day, is a shame and honor culture. So first century Jewish culture, a lot of Middle Eastern cultures, Asian cultures are very much shame and honor cultures. That's why I sometimes think that people from the Middle East or from Asia, when they read the Bible, they have more connection with it than those of us raised in a North American culture. In a shame and honor culture, the assumption is you don't want to be shamed by anything you do, think, or say. And people fear shame so much, they will do whatever it takes to avoid shame. And this couple is on the brink of the greatest shame of their lives. Because either they haven't, you know, organized things, or they're not wealthy enough to supply all the wine for the wedding. And if that comes out, if people are at a wedding where the wine runs out, or if you're at a wedding where the food runs out, or a church potluck where the food runs out, you're going to talk about that for years to come. Remember that time when we were in Cana and the wine ran out? So this couple's on the verge of the greatest shame that they will experience. And Jesus comes, lifts the shame, and replaces it with honor and with glory. Not any old wine, but the best wine. And Jesus, and I think we're going to see this in other places in the Gospel of John as well, he's always about this. Never in the way we think he will, because if I had been Jesus, I would have changed water into wine and then told everyone, guess who did this? Or at least nudge someone, make sure the news gets out. But Jesus, without drawing attention either to the couple in some ways or to himself, lifts their shame and then places this amazing honor on them. And Jesus longs to do this for us. There is so much shame in the church. There is so much shame in our lives. I think one of the indications of it is that we cannot even talk about it in a church service. Some of the things I would almost want to say about the shame in our lives, I dare not say on Sunday mornings, because of how I would feel so embarrassed and how some of you would feel so embarrassed. Not to say names, but you say, how do you know that I did that? But as we live our lives and examine our hearts, and we sometimes listen to one another, we just sense there's so much shame, and people get stuck. We get red in the face, we get embarrassed, we feel dirty, we get paralyzed, we are fearful to connect with God, the God who longs to love us. We're fearful to connect with one another because of our shame. And Jesus comes not to shame us in our shame as the bridegroom. Rather, he comes to us and he wants to lift the shame off of us, and he wants to place honor on us.